On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to today's Conversation Hour. We have remarkable guests and co-host as well, who I shall introduce in just a moment. American social psychologist and political commentator Jonathan Haidt is here. He believes that we're in an age of outrage, and he thinks that part of the reason why Western democracies are under stress is because we've got a bunch of softies who can't cope with being told no or dealing with any criticism of a personal kind, and we've kind of created, therefore, this insatiable desire for everything to be perfect and for everyone to be perfect, and no one can cope with anything other than getting their own way. I'm probably making a bit of a mess of his views, but he's going to join us shortly. First up, though, in a moment, Matt Preston. He's a judge on MasterChef, and his fellow judge is making headlines today, George Columbaris. I'm sure Matt would rather talk about practically anything to do with MasterChef except that, but I'm afraid that's not how it works. He knows. He's coming into the studio. We'll see what he's got to say about that, quite apart from where the TV show is going. And my co-host is here to perform, not just on The Conversation Hour, which she does from time to time when she drops into town. No, Hetty Kate is Paris-based but tours the world like a gypsy doing jazz. That's what she does. And she's here in Melbourne and has, I'm not quite sure why, but very generously made some time in her schedule to come into The Conversation Hour today. Morning to you.
Good morning. This is my treat. I love coming in and seeing you when I'm back in the country. So love it.
You are a gypsy, aren't you?
I am a bit of a gypsy. This was never a life goal, but maybe for people that have known me for a long time, it's not so much of a jump. But yeah, as I was saying off air, yeah, I own hardly anything. I don't have a permanent home, which does cause its own problems, and I just travel around.
All the time.
All the time.
So where have you been so people understand the life of the travelling minstrel?
In the whole last over decade of singing? This year actually hasn't been that busy because I've made a concerted effort to stay in Paris and try and be a little bit functional as a person. But I was in Taiwan. Where else will I be? I've been around France, been in Germany, and I'm going to Sicily as soon as I get back to France in August, and then I'm in England, and then I'm back here, and then possibly in New Zealand, and possibly in Hong Kong. Yeah.
So your frequent flyers be looking pretty good, wouldn't they?
They sometimes get quite exciting, and then I spend them all. I know. I should store them up, but they sort of go.
So yeah. What concerts are you here for?
I'm doing a few concerts in Melbourne. I'm doing an entire East Coast tour, actually. So I've just come back from Byron Bay, Brisbane. I did the Bellow Winter Music Festival that's just been, which is a really lovely festival. I'm at a place in St Kilda called the Ember Lounge with a man called Sam Leman, who is an extraordinary guitarist. We're playing on Tuesday night next week. And I'm joining the Daryl McKenzie Jazz Orchestra at the Paris Cat on the 29th of July. But, yeah, I've got one this Saturday night, but unfortunately it's sold out. Well, no. Fortunate. Actually,
very
that's
fortunate.
Good.
Yeah, imagine if it wasn't.
Yeah, unfortunately. Fortunately, it's sold out. But I'll be back in November to launch an album. So,
given that you're based in Paris, why would you come to Australia and particularly southern places like Melbourne in the depth of winter when so many other people flee?
I'm a bit of a winter girl, I've got to say. I puff up in summer. I've become a little bit of a sweaty puffball. And also, that's a nice visual for everyone this morning, sorry. And also, the French don't like air conditioning, John. They don't like it. There's nothing. No air conditioning. I left a 1 week's worth of 40-degree heat wave, and there's no air conditioning.
Being all up and close on the metro in the underground with all those people.
The stench of humanity. I have smelt things I never thought would be possible in my life. I can never unsmell what I have smelt.
New York's the same. They don't get summer either, and it gets swelteringly hot in New York City.
Yeah, in the metro, in the subway. What's it called? Subway over there. But yeah, the French. It's really interesting. I have had vehement arguments with French people about air conditioning. Like, it's 2019. Come on, guys, be comfortable. If we have the opportunity as humans to be comfortable, get a fan, get air conditioning. Oh, you know, air conditioning will kill you. It will make you very sick. 30 minutes in air conditioning, that's it. And I'm like, you do realize that you smoke from the moment you wake, you know? I've seen French friends, bless their cotton socks, with an e-cigarettes, you know, the chemical
vaping.
Vaping, yeah, in one hand and an actual cigarette in the
Gauloise.
Other. They've got both going at the same time.
I still have Gitane and Gauloise.
Oh, yes, I should think so.
You're not allowed to smoke in the tobacco anymore, though, are you?
People smoke everywhere in France. It's
but
just
you're supposed
constant.
To be away from food, aren't those the new rules?
Nobody. Well, yes, but honestly.
No one cares.
No, it's France, nobody. It's part of the joy there. Everyone's very rebellious and does what they like.
What's it do to you if you're in a smoke-filled room?
Well, I've got a funny story about that. It's generally not too bad, but now and then, I admit, now and then I may have the odd cigarette once every few months.
Sorry, you know. A professional singer?
Oh, come on, it's life. You've got to treat yourself now and then. Not that it's much of a treat, I've got to tell you, but I am a ex-smoker. Once a smoker, ever, always a smoker.
What do you smoke?
Massive cigars. No. Now and then I'll steal someone's cigarette and have a puff. Think
just
it's
anything.
Revolting. But how's this story? So I'm on a French TV show at the end of this year called Romance, which is a six-part TV series set in 1960s Biarritz. I'm playing, this is a massive stretch, a jazz singer.
Wow.
Get out.
Creative
Get out.
Casting.
I have been waiting my life for this role. Anyway, and I go into this amazing room. I had to sing live. It was the most extraordinary costumes. The room looked exactly like a 60s jazz club, or what I would imagine it would have looked like. Extraordinary, about 200 extras. And I was walking around thinking, doesn't this look amazing? All of the detail on the wall, the pictures, the photographs, the tables, the candles. Wow, they've even got almost completely realistic cigarette butts in the ashtrays. Wow, this is so cool. And then I realised that actually for the 12-hour shoot, with no ventilation, there were 200 French extras in there all puffing away like mad.
It was
and
real.
A smoke machine.
And you were supposed to sing over and over and over, do another take, do it again.
Yeah, we had 2 days back-to-back in that, and I lost my voice for about 2 weeks after that. It was super intense. I, you know, probably lost about 5 years of my life as well. It was fun, though.
When did you give up smoking?
Oh, look, what am I now, 42? Probably properly about 15 years ago. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you did that whole, smoking's really cool, I'm going to buy a packet.
Stole them from your mum?
No. I started smoking at about 17 or 18. I modelled when I was a young girl, and all of the models would smoke because it stopped us eating. Mm. I mean, really healthy, really great.
Kept you slim.
Mm. And we'd sit out the back of the shows, you know, not eating and just smoking. You can imagine all these gorgeous young things smelling like ashtrays. And so I actually asked a friend to teach me how to smoke because I thought it was so cool.
What do you mean, teach you?
Yeah,
how
I was
to smoke?
Like, you smoke, I want to smoke too. Teach me how to smoke.
Can you blow smoke rings?
I can.
Yeah. Apparently it's kind of fun, but I stole some cigarettes from my mother who used to smoke while she cooked, which was my enduring memory of my mother as a young boy.
Wow.
Apron on, wooden spoon in one hand, ready to whack the kids, and cigarette hanging out
it's
the side of the
fabulous,
mouth.
Fabulous, isn't it? I mean, it's not fabulous, everyone, because cigarettes are terribly bad and dreadful, and I'm certainly not extolling the benefits of it, but it's very sort of, I don't know, creates a great visual.
Well, it's very jazz.
Yeah, there have been a lot of cigarettes involved in jazz. All sorts of cigarettes.
and there's probably tributes to them as well. Matt Preston, the finals of MasterChef are underway on Network 10. He is a judge on MasterChef. He's also an occasional presenter on the ABC, of which I think there's going to be some more sometime soon, if I'm correct.
I'm stepping in to fill in for Sami Shah on Breakfast for a week, which is truly terrifying.
No, it's wonderful, Matt Preston.
It's not like doing one of these magazine shows like you do, John. It's proper news, hard-hitting, all about the right stuff.
I'm sure you'll manage. I'm sure you'll more than cope. Hey, can we get the tricky stuff out of the way first? Your friend and colleague is in the news headlines. George Colombaris, $7.8 million, 524 people, years and years of underpayment, and he's trying to say he's sorry. Are we convinced?
Well, he's paid back the money, so yeah, I would think that that would be the first way of showing you're sorry, isn't it?
Okay, so
I work with George, but I don't work for Maid, so really what I know is what I've read in the press release, and I'm sure you've read as well. The audit that happened after George's announcement in 2017, and they went back through the books and they found these underpayments, and he's now paid the vast majority of those back. So
you've spoken to him today?
I talked to him this morning. You know, he's upset because George genuinely loves the staff. That's why he wants to pay them back. I think one of the things that we would agree on is that, you know, you've got to pay staff what they own, what they're owed. You've got to pay your taxes. There are certain things you've got to pay for things you buy. These are certain things about being in a community that you have to do. And I'm glad that George paid back the first round of underpayments, and he's now paid back the majority of this round of underpayments. But it's an issue. This is a massive issue across Australia
and across the industry. Now,
not just across the industry.
How does a restaurant next door,
John, across everywhere?
Sure. How does
the ABC?
We also were underpaying some casuals. Yeah. It turned out
two and a half. How many casuals, John?
I have no idea.
2,600. So has the ABC released those figures? No. So I don't know
where you got that figure from.
Well, I got it from the Sydney Morning Herald.
We don't have 2,000 casuals.
Over 6 years, I think you've employed that. So I mean, the issue is this the right thing to do? No, of course it's not. And I think the ABC would feel that, and George would feel that same way.
How does the restaurant down the road compete when they're doing the right thing and someone up the street's doing the wrong thing? You can't compete.
No, you can't. No, and so that's why it's really great that Fair Work is out there pulling up all those people that are underpaying. Of course.
How widespread do you think it is in the industry, in the hospitality?
I think you need to ask Fair Work that question.
What's your sense? You've been in it a long time.
Well, I'm not. I'm a journalist. I'm not in the food industry. I don't run restaurants.
You've been around.
I think, and it doesn't matter whatever business you're in, there is a desire to try and work the system within the bounds of the law. Now, whether salarising your workers is a good thing to do when they're not necessarily in a salaried position, I would think at the end of the day you pay what the government has decreed or what you've agreed with the staff to pay. You've got to pay your staff what they're supposed to get paid, and I don't think George is on a different page with that.
Does it damage the brand of your TV show?
I can't answer that. You know, I mean, it all depends on how people perceive it. It also depends how the media portray it. If the media portray it as that George has taken this money and spent it and hasn't given it back, yes, then that's damaging. It's also not true. And so therefore, you know, when I hear you say that he's taken the money and he hasn't paid it back, it's important that I pull you up and say
he hasn't paid it back.
Well,
never said that.
He's
acknowledged that the problem was much larger than previously understood.
That's right.
The other thing, and I'm more than happy to put this on the record, clearly payroll is much more complex than it ever used to be. And there's all sorts of vagueness and uncertainty about what category someone fits into and what entitlements they've got, which makes it a minefield for a business operator.
But that's another debate about whether you can simplify that. Because at the end of the day, the most important thing is people get paid the agreed rate and the dollars that they deserve to get for that job. That doesn't seem to be anything other than common sense. And I mean, hopefully that Fair Work continues to do that and to make it level playing field to ensure that everyone out there who's working actually is getting paid for the job they do.
Anything else you wanted to say? Because otherwise we can move on.
No, I think that covers it.
Okay.
But you know, you need to talk to George, you need to talk to Fair Work. They're the only people who really know.
And we have spoken to Fair Work indeed on the earlier part of the program this morning. We had the Fair Work Ombudsman on, so let's move on. Do you eat French food much? Because Hetty lives in Paris. She survives on not much else.
What do you mean, not much else? It's not a bad way of surviving.
It's a pretty good way of surviving.
I think what the French do brilliantly is those classic country dishes. But also they can make a ham sandwich into something of incredible. The beurre jambon, the baguette with thick butter and ham is fantastic.
The bread there is like nothing else in any other country. I mean, bread is bread. You'd think, oh, bread is bread. Bread is bread. How many ingredients does it have in it? I don't know. Bread. But absolutely amazing. Fresh ingredients, maybe no preservatives. I don't know what they do. Some magic.
We had a French exchange student living with us for a while, and every day we would source a croissant from a different bakery until we tried to find Melbourne's best croissant.
What was Melbourne's best croissant?
According to Theo.
Yeah.
And later on, Manon, when she was here as well. Well, I'm not going to advertise for them on the ABC radio airwaves.
That's journalism research. That's good. Was it Loon? Was it Noisette? I think, that's...
It was amazing how much variation there can be in something that should be so simple.
Well, they have a competition every year for the best croissant and the best éclair in Paris, so you can find out exactly where to go to get the best one.
There's a judging job I'd like.
I'm banned. I've banned myself. I'm on, I can't go to the boulangerie. I'll just buy a whole baguette and go home and eat the whole thing.
Yeah, it's amazing that in the last few years, it was originally all about the macaron and Pierre Hermé and these crazy macaron. The éclair has become now the coolest pastry in Paris. Is that still the case?
I have never eaten an éclair in Paris. Can you believe it? I've been there for 2.5 years. I've bought one and eaten one.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm not really into all the cream and stuff. It's
the one I really like? You know those two meringues put together with chocolate on the outside and kind of mousse on the middle?
Do you mean the ones that look like nuns, the religieuses, the two little shoe buns?
No. Two meringues. Two pieces of meringue, white meringue, put together like a yo-yo with fondue, sort of chocolate fondue in the middle and a bit of ice, a bit of chocolate topping holding them together.
See, this is patisserie land, and I'm generally spend most of my life in boulangerie land, so I'm not totally up with patisserie items, and I've eaten too many macarons.
The other thing the French have done enormously is those pre-cooked meals that you pick up on your way home. You stop off, you pick up a meal ready to go, not hot, but ready to go.
Well, they have the frozen supermarket, Picard.
Yeah, Picard as well.
Which, Star Trek reference, fantastic.
But that's the same thing. You go to a supermarket in the UK and you'll find that, large swathes of real estate the fact that we don't have a kind of ready meal, pick up meal market here makes us unusual, because it's massive in America, it's massive in France, it's massive in the UK.
Why? I wonder why we wouldn't.
Because we like to cook, because cooking is good.
Okay, that's true.
that was a bit of a political statement.
That was good.
Except now you've got the explosion in what are called meal kit companies. Yeah. And there's a number of them, I won't advertise for them, but it takes all the shopping out, the quantities
out. You get everything together.
You get a bag and everything you need is in there, except maybe some oil, salt, pepper, or the basics that are in the pantry anyway.
But it hasn't been cut fresh by you.
No, you do. There are some fresh cuts. Some of them, there'll be a carrot, and it'll say, cut the carrot.
We tried that for a month because one of them is run by an ex-MasterChef contestant, and it was like, that's great, well done. And I thought it's a great idea. I like
cuts down on waste, cuts down on shopping time, and in fact, we've been doing it for a bit. The meals are delicious.
And you actually get to cook different stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's broadening repertoire is fantastic. I'd still rather go and buy a pumpkin, roast it, put stock in it, call it soup. I think one of the challenges is demystifying cooking, so you realise that it is quicker than walking to the supermarket and buying stuff. The other issue we had, obviously I've got two teenage boys, was that those meal kits were kind of, there just wasn't enough food for the rower and the footballer, because they want a chicken,
a whole one,
each course.
Teenage boys eat a lot of food.
So I've heard. Yeah, so I've heard. But you can, you know, you can double up and all the rest of it. But you're right, because they have, they introduce you to a whole lot of things that otherwise you wouldn't. The other day we had, it was like a Japanese miso soup with chicken and vegetables in it. And so it took you through step by step what to do. And then sort of go, well, you never would have cooked that.
Yeah, and I think that's really exciting. But I think it's a, but it, hopefully all these meal kits become a gateway drug. They become the thing you try and you fall in love with. And then you go and do it yourself, because you can buy your own miso, you can buy your own chicken, your own vegetable, and it becomes quite easy. Because really, you know, we live in an era where mystification of skills and technique is everywhere. And actually, these things aren't that simple. And you should be able to do it yourself. And your 11-year-old, 12-year-old child should be able to do it and do it for you.
Best declares Apollo Bay.
Can you believe that? It's a bit far for me to get there.
Just for the
South. Do they deliver?
Amazing croissants in Bendigo, apparently. So
yeah, nice.
Okay. Do they deliver as well?
Also, Uber Eats.
Yeah, I'm going to send an Uber up there to get one croissant. From Bendigo. I don't know. That pretty, a good croissant is worth it.
What's Matt Preston's view of the food delivery systems?
They can be very expensive for the restaurants. They can clog up the roads. I quite like the idea of walking down to the shop. It's interesting that McDonald's in the US has just stopped its exclusive agreement with Uber Eats to do other groups. It's a massive phenomenon over there, home delivery.
And now you've got restaurants that are giving up on having tables and customers. They're just kitchens.
Well,
and
yeah,
the food is all produced to be delivered. They're not even interested in having people
sitting
in there.
But I think being a catastrophist, I have a horrid image of a black kitchen somewhere, where people who are being paid minimum wage are throwing together recipes based on licensed dishes that are created that don't come from the restaurant, and it becomes like a cover band rather than the real restaurant. And I don't know why that shouldn't make a difference. Who cooks it? It doesn't make a difference if it's cooked in
whatever it tastes like.
Yeah, whatever it tastes like. But psychologically, I like the fact that the local dumpling shop gets to be the local dumpling shop, and I get to either, you know, buy some frozen, pick some up takeaway, potentially order it in, or also go and sit in there and eat, and then not have the washing up and any of the guilt about the paper bag, the plastic box, or the paper box it comes from, and all those other waste issues, because waste is everywhere.
So what do you think about, I watched this really interesting little mini documentary on YouTube the other day, and it was set in London, and the premise was that you don't really have to have that much of a license, allegedly, I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, to be a restaurant on Uber Eats. And this person set up a fake restaurant, yeah, it was quite bizarre, and actually got listed, and it was quite funny. Like they, it was English humour, so they had it set up in a skip. But anyway, let's move on from that.
What, you would order food and it never arrived?
No, you'd order food, but there was no kind of check that it was a working kitchen.
Okay.
There was no checking actually what the meal was. I've ordered this particular curry. Is it actually that curry? Whereas I think in a restaurant, when you're actually going there are going to be checks. There's going to be
accountable. Wow, that's interesting. And look, you know, certainly we're starting to see, there's a great little restaurant called Entervar Laundry, which is someone cooking in their home one day a week.
Oh.
And it's great, and it's probably the hardest table to get in Melbourne, and it's delicious. And I like that idea of, you know, people who want to cook for you, cooking for you. So I'd rather break it down into smaller community pods rather than the danger. I think is that you end up ordering the famous dumpling from the famous dumpling shop in the city rather than one from the restaurant around the corner. And I think it'd be sad if we lost those smaller local places.
And the best dumpling isn't necessarily always going to be the best dumpling, because things come and go, and people go off and cooks leave and someone else
comes in. But also more importantly, at the end of the day, if you go to the restaurant where the chef is cooking, you're getting that food and it's probably pretty good. But the moment it gets filtered down to, you know, that sold as a license, that comes as a menu, they're now producing 10 million of them rather than 500 of them, you know, that often has an impact on quality.
And just finally, I've noticed a trend. We don't do the fine dining, we more do the cheap eats end of the market, but many, many restaurants and cafes now have much smaller menus, much less variety, so there's less waste.
Yeah.
That's a way of surviving, is that what it's about?
I think it's also common sense, isn't it? You also want to maintain the quality of the product. produce. You want to be cooking a limited number of things, so you don't have stuff hanging around for 2-3 days. I think it's great. I mean, that gets back to that French or the Italian idea, where you go to a restaurant because it specializes in duck,
yes.
Or it does, or you go to the place just to have the rabbit stew.
Yeah.
And I like that idea of the, you know, even less waste is this model of the prefix A, where you go and have you can go and have a choice of maybe two starters, two mains, two desserts, so you kind of know exactly what you're going to get. And the this kind of modern era thing of choice, where we demand, you know, everything from everyone, is not necessarily something that I'm comfortable with.
Matt Preston, foodie broadcaster and judge on MasterChef, was our first guest on The Conversation Hour today with Hetty Kate. Our next guest is the American psychologist Jonathan Haidt. He's Professor of Ethical Leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business, and he thinks we're living in an age of outrage. Imagine someone who teaches ethical leadership. You'd think they'd be rather busy, wouldn't they, Jonathan? Welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Thank you, John. Yes, well, in a business school, every title has to have leadership in it. So since I study moral psychology, they just stuck on leadership.
And does anyone come to your classes on ethical leadership?
Well, it's a pretty good skill to for future business leaders to know at least what they will be held accountable for.
And does anyone pass the exam on ethical leadership?
Yeah, it's easy to pass the exams. It's the real world follow-up that's so hard.
Are people set for remedial classes?
I think there's some use for that, yes.
More than. So your principal speech in Melbourne at the Convention Exhibition Centre is about the age of outrage.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think we're living in an age of outrage?
So I'm a social psychologist, and I study morality and moral judgment, and the way that humanity evolved to live in small groups where we're always trying to manage our reputations. In fact, we care more about what people think about us than we do about almost anything else. And so what would happen if we suddenly got connected up such that not only do I have to worry about what you think or how I appear to you, but to millions of total strangers who are all trying to show off for others? And that's, I think, kind of what happened to us in the last 10 years or so. It's as though, imagine the universe with all these planets and stars circling around. And one day, God said, what would happen if I just reached into the universe and changed the gravitational constant? Let's triple it just for fun. Let's just see what happens. And that's kind of what happened when Facebook and other social media companies connected us all up with ways to punish and reward each other. Things are going haywire.
In the 1890s, people invented the internal combustion engine, and within a few years, we had motor cars. But it took at least another decade before we had rules to go with the motor cars on what side of the road you drove on and what would happen if you ran into a horse and cart, whether you needed a license, and the insurance took even longer. So aren't we in a process of transition? We've got this new technology, we just haven't worked out the rules for it yet, just like happened 100 years ago.
To some extent, yes, that is surely going to happen. The difficulty, though, or rather the problem with the comparison, is if you're talking about people moving physical things through space in which they can physically harm each other, it's very clear how and why the government must get involved. If we're talking about people saying words where it's not so clear, it's very hard to show the harm. I hope we'll get into it soon. I think I can show the harm that it's doing to teenage mental health. That
I don't think there's any doubt about
that. Yeah, that I think is clear. So I do think that we will be able to, if we scientists can make the case clearly that is damaging teen mental health, I think we can get the ages raised. But what do we do with adults? How are we going to regulate or limit social media use by consenting adults when it's very hard to show direct harm? So I don't think we will succeed in regulating social media the way we've succeeded in regulating motor cars.
Don't know why not. You can hold the platforms accountable for what they distribute in exactly the same way as a TV station, a radio program, or a newspaper editor is responsible for what they publish. I don't see the problem. Obviously, Amazon, you know, Google, all these, you know, Facebook, these giants who are very influential, incredibly wealthy, very powerful, they're arguing they shouldn't be held accountable, but that's in the they would say that category as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So there are several different sets of problems. The one I'm most concerned about is the teenage mental health problem. And as we said, that when we think there will be some things we can do. A second one is the fake news problem, and that's the one that most people in media are concerned about. And there, too, I agree with you. There will be ways to hold the platforms more responsible than they are. So I think there will be progress on that. But the third one is the one that gets talked about the least, and that is just the basic social psychology problem of connecting people up in ways that incentivize outrage and dishonesty. Mm. And that's the one where it's much harder to see how to regulate it. That's the one which I think ultimately is what is going to do in democracies. Again, I shouldn't get ahead of myself here. I mean, I'm not confident in this, but this is the one that I, as a social psychologist, am most alarmed about. It's not the fake news. It's the everyday interactions. It's the way it shapes the rest of us.
Whether democracies are going to be undone is clearly an important question.
That's the big question,
but anonymity of online presence and social media is the core here. If you strip that away, if you compel, I mean, if I want to open a bank account, I have to produce a passport, mm-hmm. driver's license, all that stuff. If you strip away the anonymity from social media, doesn't that solve most of the problem?
That would be the biggest single step that I can think of. Yeah, I think that the fact that people can now create an account with no identification, and then they can make death threats and say terrible racist things, this creates a toxic environment.
And multiple accounts,
So that would help.
What I find so interesting is that the whole idea of social media was going to bring together into different people into different tribes. But it seems, judging from what you say, that once people get into tribes, it actually takes normally reasonable people and puts them into a totally different psychological space where they start attacking and showing off to the rest of the tribe.
We're in an echo chamber as well, aren't we? I mean, we only hear what we agree with on Facebook and things like that. And so it's easy to attack the other because you never see the other. You're never encountering it. Mm-hmm. So
that's right. It kind of plays up certain innate social tendencies and downplays others. And the result is, I think, an increase in this sort of tribal and aggressive behavior. Yes, I agree.
Mm. So one of the things we're grappling with in this age of outrage is how it's changing our democracies. You said a moment ago you thought it was threatening democracy.
Yes.
How profoundly do you think that's advanced? How far do you think it's gone?
Yeah. Here I am coming to you from the United States, where it does rather seem apocalyptic to many. Certainly people on the left have had the sense since November 9th of 2016.
What happened then?
Oh, well, that was the day that we woke up and discovered that Donald Trump had been elected president. And so it does seem as though it's sort of the end times. And, oh, my God, I mean, just it's every week it's another outrage. So this week in the United States, it's all about Donald Trump tweeted about some young female congresswomen who are of non-white heritage. He said, you should go back where you came from or go back if you don't like it here. And so this is the outrage of the week. Now, Donald Trump is an overt racist, but our entire political life now is spent over things like this. It's symbolic stuff. It's nasty stuff.
There's no coincidence there, though. This is deliberate. It's calculated.
Well, with Trump, I'm not so sure about that. If Trump was Machiavellian, if Trump was calculated and Machiavellian, he would be extremely effective.
Trump, you don't think he is?
No, I don't. I think he has very little frontal cortical function. He's not able to restrain his impulses. And he does things that certainly seem to hurt him, although in the long run, American politics is so messed up that someone who just punches the left, punches the certain targets, will attract the support of some people on the right.
Kellyanne Conway, the press secretary, challenged a reporter and asked her, what's your ethnicity, when she asked a question about whether Donald Trump was racist. This notion from, in particular, the kind of Trump base, that unless you're a white Christian, you're not legitimate, you shouldn't play a role, you shouldn't have a place, you're not supposed to get out of your position. Mm-hmm. That's underpinning all of this. It's the fundamental equation that's behind all of this, is it not?
Well, Trump's psychology here, I think, is the way you've described it, I think, does capture the way that he thinks about identity. And that is a way that many people around the world do think about identity, that it is in your blood and it comes down to you.
There's a hierarchy of races?
For many people, yes. And this is what was so great about America in the 20th century was it was a long move away from that way of thinking. I'm Jewish. When I was growing up in the suburbs of New York City, my parents told me about what it was like when they were kids in New York City, where, the Jews they ran the schools and the Irish were the police. And as my grandmother said to my mother, if you don't meet them, you won't fall in love with them and there won't be any problems. And that's the way it was. It was ethnically separated. And by the time I was going to school, in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't like that at all. And we'd made so much progress getting away from this relentless, you're this, you're that. And now it's all coming back.
Progress is neither inevitable nor linear.
We're learning that.
We are.
To what degree do you think the outrage and those expressions actually will? I mean, we've seen it. We've seen those statements make big changes in the way that we view things. Like, well, gay marriage would be a great example of how social media was used. In America, do you think the danger is that people fire off on social media without actually going to their party meeting, trying to, sending money to Bernie Sanders to oust Trump? Is there increased political activism to go with that increased angst and outpourings?
Well, I don't know about total quantity of political activism. What we can say with some confidence about what's changing recently is that social media enables certain voices to become much louder. Mm. And as they get much louder, a large number, probably the majority of people, just stop talking because it's not worth it. And so there were recently studies published in the New York Times showing how if you look at what registered Democrats believe or want, what they want in a candidate, what they believe about policy. And then you look at Democrats active on Twitter, they're very, very far apart. In other words, people on Twitter are much further to the left. And the same dynamic happens on the right. Most Americans are pretty reasonable and moderate. Maybe soon we'll talk about what's happening on university campuses. Most professors and students are pretty reasonable and moderate. But in the new social media age, the people who want to make the biggest fuss, the people who want to intimidate others and, quote, call out others, they are given a constant platform, and the rest of us then respond to it. So I see what's happening not as that people are going crazy. It's that the dynamic has changed so that what comes out in public is ever more unrepresentative of the average.
How often have you heard someone's response to an outrage being, you can't say that, rather than I disagree with you and here's why, but it's you can't say that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's more a religious way of thinking. This is what we're seeing. So my second book, The Righteous Mind, was really about how humans evolved as tribal creatures. Religion was one of our key innovations that allowed us to band together in groups to compete with or fight with other groups. So religion's built into our minds, and it was quite an achievement of the West to create these secular democracies where you had religious freedom, but religion wasn't central to our practice of politics. Well, my fear is that our religious minds are now increasingly used for our politics. And so
they're used for our politics?
So what I mean is here I am coming from a university environment in which there are not supposed to be any blasphemy laws. We're supposed to be able to talk about anything in good faith. And if you've got the data to back it up, you should be able to say it. But increasingly, we're seeing sort of quasi-blasphemy laws where issues about gender differences or immigration or inequality, all sorts of things where you can make a claim and you won't be argued with. People won't say, no, you're wrong and here's why. They'll say you're bad and therefore you shouldn't be saying that.
France is not immune to this, Hetty. What are you seeing where you're living in Paris?
I found it really interesting, actually, because I think France is, from the people that I interact with, which is mostly musicians, and they're a lot younger people than I interact with in Australia. I'm out with sort of 25 to 32-year-old musicians, a bit younger than me, not that much younger than me. And it's very open. People don't mind being a bit offensive over there. You can have an opinion. Whereas I find a lot of people here, even just in my own small interactions on Facebook and social media, people are happy to jump in and people get very offended and aggressive and attack instead of just rebutting or sharing their opinion, and it's quite bizarre to me.
But there was an old idea that if you went to someone's house for dinner, you didn't discuss religion, you didn't discuss politics. These were private things you kept in your old world.
Polite company. That's right.
But how do we get back? How do we take the debate back? Move it away from the far left, the far right, and move it towards a world of consensus. Is that possible, or is it too late?
Well, it'd be very difficult to do that now. The genie is out of the bottle, as it were. I just recently reread the biblical story of Babel, and humans say, well, let's build this tower up to the heavens. And God says, come, let us go down and confound their language. And that's kind of what has happened to us, that social media was supposed to bring us together. That was the initial idea. But it has confounded us. It has brought out many of the worst tendencies. And we are now living in the post-Babel age. I was very interested, Hetty, what you said about in France it seems more relaxed, more easygoing. Mm. There's a weird thing happening in the Anglosphere, in the English-speaking countries. Our universities are going through similar dynamics, whereas on the continent, in France and Germany and in Scandinavia, it doesn't seem to be happening as much. just recently we've seen in the United States some interesting analyses as to why. So there's all these interesting reports about the layout of the American political landscape. More in Common did this hidden tribe study. They broke us up into seven different groups based on our attitudes. And the far right group is the whitest of all the groups, and they're the most conservative. The far left group is the second whitest of all the groups. And they are extremely illiberal. They're the ones who do the call-out culture. They're the ones to say you can't say that. Most Americans are pretty moderate. They're what's called the exhausted majority. But the battle is between this far right, white, generally educated and wealthy group and this far left, white and educated group. And there are all these interesting analyses of how word usage has changed. In the New York Times, it's called the Great Awokening. Word use about whiteness and privilege skyrocketed in the last few years. So something weird is happening among English-speaking white people on the left.
And what do they both have in common?
What do they both have in common? I don't know. What
They represent the two strands of a fairly established elite.
Yes. David Brooks called an essay on this the rich white civil war.
Wow. Which is what we're seeing.
And, have it in Australia too?
And then you have a lot of other people, in particular people who come from all sorts of different mixed heritage, often more recent arrivals, and they're just aspirational, and they don't understand what all the noise is about.
Exactly. Same thing in America. That's right.
They're saying, well, we just want to raise our kids and get what you guys have all taken for granted for a few generations.
Well, it's a luxury, isn't it? It's a luxury to sit there and be
once you're established,
complain.
Once you're comfortable, once you feel hooked in, part of, safe, secure, and you know your place in the order of things, wherever it might be, left or right, then you have the indulgence of starting to question this stuff.
That's right, the indulgence.
But this is your point about the idea that order tends to decline, it tends to fall apart, it tends to decay, and that you need some way of stopping that decay once you achieve that order.
Well, that's right. This, I think, is a very helpful way to think about the challenge we face in having diverse secular liberal democracies, which is that they're not natural. Humans are a tribal species. We easily affiliate on certain lines. It could be race or not race. It doesn't have to be. And so if you look at the forces pulling a group together or separate or pulling them apart, and you look at the balance, so a lot of us in the 20th century, especially those of us on the Commonwealth side, we fought the Nazis, then we fought the Cold War. We had a lot of forces pulling us together. We had a centralizing media system, only temporarily. We had three television networks in the United States. So then in the 1990s, we were kind of lulled into the belief that liberal democracy was easy and that it was a path of progress from here on out. And boy, were we wrong. It's a lot harder than we thought.
Yeah. So as well as having classes in ethical leadership, we also somehow need to return to teaching resilience.
Teaching resilience, I would say giving kids the kinds of experience that would lead to resilience. In American universities now, it's all the rage to give them courses on how to fail, courses on how to be resilient. What a waste of time. Resilience is something you build up by direct experience of failure. And to the extent that we've protected
my gifted special child must never experience
it's disappointment what they call helicopter parenting and you making sure that your children don't have to suffer or be confronted.
We're so far beyond helicopter. Now we call it concierge parenting and snowplow parenting.
I've heard someone say this. I never want my child to cry.
Wow.
I have heard a parent say that.
That's like saying, I never want my child exposed to any sort of germs or dirt.
And I don't want my child knowing that people die, for instance.
That's straight out of the Buddha story.
And you know what you have to do? In fact, if you're worried about your kid getting sick, get your kid to play in the dirt a bit more and muck around and, you know, eat some piece of muck that should have been thrown away and everything, and then you
possum poo, John. The secret is possum poo. It's all about eating possum poo.
Then you get a Bulli ulcer and you'll start.
I think
we need food delivery services that deliver possum poo by car.
Yeah, there we go.
But safe, healthy.
And maggots.
Safe. Delicious.
I've seen leeches doing that job. Jonathan Haidt is an American social psychologist, professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. Matt Hetty, Kate, thank you all for coming on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and all the rest of it as well.